On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Risk Assessment and Risk Management, Determination and Application of Risk-Based Values. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Risk Assessment Resources Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the first few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors from the ITRC Risk Assessment Resources Team. As listed on the slide, today's training course is based on the documents, the Site Screening Values document, Evaluation of Risk-Based Screening Values and Approaches of Selected States. We also refer to the electronic fact sheet for risk assessment. And we'll take you to the links at the end of the training where both of these documents and resources are available for you to download. We also make available the presentation itself, and again, at the link at the end, we'll show you how to download that. In addition to what you'll see on the slides, there's more information available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded version. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council and hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network. If you move to slide 2, and if you're new to ClueIn, it's the series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate, and it's the third button, the single right arrow, that's going to allow you to move forward. We'll go through some housekeeping quickly. Today's course is 2.25 hours, and we are going to have 3 question and answer breaks during our training course. For our phone line participants, you are welcome to ask questions during those question and answer breaks, and we'll remind you at that time how to unmute your phone. It's *7 to unmute. But I have muted all the lines, so we eliminate background noise for now. For our simulcast audience, you're also welcome to ask questions. You can use the question mark button on the top of your slides that will allow you to send in a question to me. I'll receive that as a moderator, and we'll get to as many questions as we can during the question and answer breaks. If you are having any troubles with our system, remember to turn off your pop-up blockers, as that may be stopping our system from working properly. As you move through the slides, the series of orange icons at the top allow you to navigate. There's also a list of slide numbers along the left that is going to allow you to jump through if you need to go back or forward. We do have a feedback form associated with today's training class, and we're going to ask everyone on the call to fill out that feedback form before you leave the training website today. It is information that we use, and we really do appreciate it if you take a few minutes to fill out the feedback form. And that's available from the last slide of today's training class. Today's training event is being recorded, and we offer archives of our previous training classes, and I've listed the website at the bottom of this slide where you can access the archives of over 40 different trainings from ITRC, as well as many more from other organizations that work with EPA. On slide 3, this slide includes the ITRC disclaimer and copyright. We include this information in all ITRC training presentations and ask that you please read over the slide. In short, it says we've tried to provide accurate and reliable information but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide 4, I'm going to tell you briefly about ITRC, and I've included the link to the ITRC website at the top of this slide so you can learn more. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States, and overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators, includes federal partners, for example, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. This diverse group works together on a team, and teams address different topics that may be a technology or a type of contaminant or a type of site. They communicate their results through technical and regulatory guidance documents and training classes like today's training. On slide 5, you can see some examples of the training classes that we're offering in 2010. We continue to offer popular courses from previous years as well as develop new courses each year. We also have a 2-day training class on vapor intrusion pathway, and registration is now open for the class in July. That's going to be held in the Boston, Massachusetts area. More information is available on the ITRC website under Internet-based training and classroom training. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors. All of our instructors are members of the ITRC Risk Assessment Resources Team. That team was led by Steve Dizio of the California Department of Toxic Substance Control, and Brian Espy of the Alabama Department of Environmental Management. Finnett Kotler is a branch supervisor at the State of Nevada Petroleum Fund at the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, located in Carson City. Since 2002, he has given technical, regulatory, and fiscal oversight on remediation cases ranging from residential heating oil tanks to a site used to test engines for the space shuttle program. Anna Butler is a technical manager of the Savannah District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Georgia. Anna works with risk assessors on the preparation and interpretation of risk assessment for multiple RCRA sites, as well as corrective action decisions. If you move to slide 7, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Bennett Kotler of the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection. Bennett?
Thanks, Juliana. On slide 7, you can see what we want you to take from this presentation. And if you can keep your focus on understanding the basis, the approaches, and the uses of values, you'll really get a lot of benefit out of what we're trying to communicate today. You really don't have to worry about the numbers themselves, even though, you know, that's what we use and it makes our jobs easier. The first reason is that the values change, and you'll see as part of this presentation, I'll point out a few instances where that occurred. So if you're trying to memorize numbers, then don't worry because they're going to change on you, and you can look them up. And ultimately, you'll have a much deeper knowledge if you understand the application and the basis of any given set of, say, screening values. And our little mascot for this program is that field technician, well-dressed and with a hand auger, to remind you to try to dig down and understand what's going on beneath the numbers. So, as Julian indicated, we have a team of people, and it consists of state and federal regulators, representatives from the Army Corps of Engineers, citizen stakeholders, members of the tri-services, the U.S. military, and we all spent about 2 years surveying regulators, reviewing data, and discussing the ways that U.S. states use risk assessments to screen and ultimately clean up contaminated sites. And what you see is one of the fruits of our labor, and that's this presentation. We assume that you're literate in risk assessment but have a limited understanding. So you're probably a risk manager, project manager, but if you're a risk assessor, you know too much, and you've already wrestled with many of the issues we'll address. I will point out that on April 27th, we are going to give a second presentation, which is more advanced. So those of you with a deeper understanding, or once you graduate from this one, and you know, you won't actually receive a certificate, but after this one, there will be another advanced presentation on April 27th, and you should go to the Cluins site to look for that. What we'll do is we'll start with an introductory module to set the foundations, set the foundation for the other modules and highlight and clarify some key concepts. In a second module in this presentation, we'll present the results of a survey of 13 states where we compared the screening levels that each of the states are using. And secondarily, we're going to try to dig into the assumptions and the algorithms used to develop those screening levels. And that's all with an eye towards gaining a deeper understanding of the approaches that are being used in risk assessment from around the country. And in the very last module, we're going to present two case studies of risk-based remediation, and we're going to try to see, okay, well, how is risk assessment actually used in a site, in site remediation? And again, all with an eye towards not second-guessing what any decisions have been made or what data people used or collected, but to make us all better at managing our projects and understanding how risk assessment and risk management is done. Throughout the presentation, we'll reference resources that the ITRC Risk Assessment Resources Team developed, including the published state screening values document, which is the basis for this online training, an electronic fact sheet with link to key risk assessment resources on the internet. And lastly, the second document that the team put together, a 2008 document that's the basis for Module 3, and that second training that I spoke about, and that one is the use of risk, is entitled The Use of Risk Assessment in Management of Contaminated Sites. And then lastly, go back to the Kluwin website, and you'll see a link to some 36 additional resources. So there's a lot of good stuff out there. Slide 8. We hope that this training is a quick way to see how U.S. states handle risk-based cleanups from the initial screening to the basis of the screening and to the cleanup itself. And we hope that you'll get an increased understanding of the development and application of these risk-based levels, both used for screening and remediating, and that'll improve your oversight and project management and work with toxicologists. And if you're going to do risk assessments, you should make friends with toxicologists and get them involved in the process early. And that's something that, for those of you that may have been involved in triad training or expedited site assessment, should know that you should get your team together early, get everybody on board, get consensus, so that you can all navigate your way through the difficult decision-making of a project without fighting with each other. Secondly, you know, if any of you are coming up with new regulations or if you work interstate, we hope that the comparison of states' regulatory approaches will be of value to you. I know that there are people, say, in Department of Defense, Department of Energy, or even consultants that cover an area that includes, say, Northern California and Northern Nevada. And they probably go over the Sierra Mountains, and they feel like they're traveling between two different worlds, right? One with a relatively high level of regulatory an appetite for regulatory oversight. The environments are different. You might have projects that are located at 6,000 feet in fractured bedrock of Lake Tahoe, and then you come down some ancient lake bed in the Great Basin. So you can't just use a cookie cutter approach. And we're hoping that some of the discussion we have will help you with that kind of thing. And, you know, we're also going to push an idea that when in doubt, you should be transparent to the regulated community, both the policymakers and the public. They may challenge regulators. They may challenge you and your clients about why are things different as you go from one state to the next. Ultimately, numbers don't speak for themselves, and it's important that your scientific work be accepted. You know, in some ways, I think a frontier science like a risk assessment has some of the same problems that a frontier science of climate change has, and we see what a mess climate change is in terms of getting the science to be accepted and getting consensus so that a set of management decisions can be made. It's kind of similar to problems that some of us may have. And ultimately, you'll see that I'll present a case study where in, say, the state of Florida, being transparent with stakeholders actually improved the exposure assessment, improved the work that was done. Well, with that introduction, I'd like to turn the program over to Anna Butler for Module 1. She's a technical manager from Savannah District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Anna?
Hey, mm-hmm. Anna, this is Juliana. Remember to select star 7 to unmute.
Thank you, Ben and Juliana. I had pressed star 6 instead of star 7. Hopefully you guys can hear me now. And as Bennett said, the first module is going to be an introductory module in which we basically highlight the relationship between risk assessment and risk management. So let's move on to slide number 10. In particular, in Module 1, we're going to look at the role of screening levels and how they are or were developed and how they're used in risk assessment and how they fit in the risk assessment and risk management processes that we all use. And we're also going to look at how they differ, screening levels differ from risk-based remediation levels. As Bennett pointed out, many of you participating today come from a variety of backgrounds. Some may have some familiarity with risk assessment, and some of you may be totally new to the risk assessment concepts. So because of that, we're going to first review the basic risk assessment concepts in Module 1, and then we're going to focus more in Module 2 and 3 on developing or exploring some of these concepts. And finally, in Module 1, we're going to identify the role that risk communication plays in the decision-making processes. And again, I'd like to point out, as Bennett did, that this training class today is not intended to train people to perform risk assessments, and it's not going to solve any problematic areas where there might be a lack of guidance or reference data, but it's intended to illustrate the importance of clarity and transparency in all phases of risk management, from the development of the screening levels onward to making risk management decisions. Let's move to slide 11, please. And one other thing before we get started, I just would like to point out that the ICRC risk team put together a resource that we call the Electronic Risk Resource Sheet, which in which we compiled approximately 65 hyperlinks to current reference materials and guidance documents that are commonly used in risk assessment and risk management. And this resource fact sheet can be found on the ICRC website that's located at www.icrcweb.org. Once there at the homepage, click on the link for guidance documents, then follow the link for risk resources, and at the bottom of that page, you'll find the link for the electronic fact sheet. And they do try to keep the links up to date and updated periodically. And so it's a great place to, if you're searching for reference material, it's a great place to go. Let's move on to slide 12, please. Now, risk management includes both the decision-making processes used to control risk from a site, and also the ongoing management of any corrective measures that are taken to control these risks. So, as we know, both risk assessments and site investigations can generate a lot of quantitative data, and risk management decisions made by the risk managers, they have to integrate all this data with other factors such as the cost and feasibility of any proposed corrective action technologies, and also some qualitative issues, such as the policies of the regulatory agencies involved, social and political issues of the area, and public acceptance and stakeholder acceptance of any selected plan or corrective action. Because of this, risk communication between all these parties involved becomes a very important factor in the risk management process. And we're going to briefly touch on that, too, in this module. Let's move to slide 13, please. Slide 13 shows the continuum for how risk assessment is used in the management of risk at a site cleanup. Now, we all know that sites come in many different sizes and scope and magnitude, and the variety of contaminants and degree in contamination at a site is really what's going to control the remediation efforts and the level of management that's going to be necessary for each site. So you can see from the chart on slide 13 that risk management decisions are going to be simple for those sites with little to no contamination at the left side of the chart, as well as the decision will be simple for those sites on the right side of the chart, those sites with very high levels of contamination, because it's going to be obvious that some type of corrective action is necessary. But it's that gray area in between where these risk management decisions are sometimes more complicated and controversial. And this is usually the area where more information is needed in order to make a decision. And this is where risk assessments are useful, because they provide this information that people need in order to make a decision on what to do at a site. Risk assessments are really the tools that are used to develop the screening levels and remediation levels that are used in risk management decisions. Let's move to slide 14, please. So for our purposes today, risk at a contaminated site is defined as the probability that harmful effects can occur due to a site exposure. The risk assessment will evaluate and characterize any potential adverse effects for both human and ecological acceptors to an exposure at these sites. Slide 15, please. And that is really the value of a risk assessment. They provide the documentation for who or what could be at risk from a site exposure, and they also evaluate the need for corrective action. And because risk assessments are based on scientific data, data that you've collected from a site, and on scientific processes, they provide a defensible basis to support your risk management decisions. And risk assessments can also provide an added benefit by aid you in saving money and time in the remediation process. They do this by providing a risk-based remediation level to use for cleanup levels instead of remediating a site to background levels or non-detect. They also allow you to focus any corrective action on the exposure pathways and contaminants that present the greatest risk to an receptor. Let's move to slide 16, please. Okay, so now, just real briefly, we're going to review the basic components of a risk assessment. The first step is the data collection and evaluation. The second step takes the data that you collected, but the second step actually is where you look for the toxicity and exposure assessments for the chemicals you identify in your data collection. And then finally, the third step, you combine all this data and to the risk characterization of your site, which allows you to identify any and all potential risks that could occur to a receptor from a site exposure. Slide 17, please. Now, the first thing you need to do in the data collection step, because you just need to step back and evaluate your site, look at the overall big picture of the site and the slight history in order to identify the sources of contamination, the transport mechanisms for all possible contaminants, as well as your receptors and pathways for exposure. This process is often called developing your site conceptual model. And you need to do this in order to identify all areas that you need to collect samples and what types of samples that you need to collect for your site, because you're going to need to do this in order to make sure you have enough data for the risk assessment, because a lot of the data needed for a risk assessment for an exposure to a site is different from a data that you're going to collect just for plume delineation or contaminant delineation. So the first step is to look back at your site and develop your sampling and plan and get your risk assessors involved so you can identify all media and all areas that you need to collect your samples from. And you can see that communication is going to be important at this stage, because a lot of times the people in the field collecting the samples are not really the same people that are going to be doing the risk assessment and making the risk management decisions. So they're going to need to understand why you may need to collect some samples that aren't necessarily related to your plume contaminant delineation process. And then after your data is collected, it's compared to the existing regulatory levels, which depend, of course, on the regulatory program that's guiding your particular site investigation. At this point, generally, the chemicals that exceed these levels are moved on to further assessment and investigation, while the others are quote, screened out because they do not exceed these levels. And hence, that's where the term screening levels developed. And we're going to look at screening levels in more detail later in this module and also in Module 2. Slide 18, please. Now, during the toxicity assessment stage, information is gathered for all your identified chemicals of concern at a site about the various dose response studies for each of the chemicals of interest. And this information is used to provide a description of any potential adverse effects that you might expect to find from an exposure to these compounds at your site. The appropriate toxicity value is selected for use in your risk assessment calculations as well. And when it comes to toxicity levels and the effects of the chemicals, these compounds are generally divided into two broad categories. The first category is the carcinogenic substances, which are chemicals from which an exposure could result in a cancer. And toxicity values for these chemicals are taken from a slope of the curve derived from a dose response study, and they're called, the actual toxicity values are called a cancer slope factor. And really it's not the slope of the curve, but it's the 95% upper confidence level of the slope from the dose response curve. The second category are the non-carcinogenic substances, which is basically everything else that's not carcinogenic. And generally these are chemicals for which there is no effect from exposure until the dose or exposure exceeds a certain threshold level. And for this class of chemicals, the toxicity values are described by using a reference dose. For an exposure above this reference dose, you might expect to see an effect. And then the reference doses for the non-carcinogenic compounds are usually based on what toxicologists call the no effect or lowest observed effect levels from a dose response study. And sometimes it's not the exact number, but there's a safety factor built in. And it's also important to note that some compounds or chemicals exhibit both types of effects, both carcinogenic and non-carcinogenic substances, and that needs to be included in your risk assessment, of course. Let's move on to slide 19. Now, also during the exposure assessment, the site conceptual model that you develop during your planning stages is refined using the site data that has been collected. The exposure setting is characterized and all the receptors and pathways that could result in a potential exposure are identified. Also, those pathways that will not result in exposure can be eliminated from further evaluation or investigation. The exposure for each receptor is quantified by calculating the intake or dose for each site-related constituent. And this is commonly done by calculating a dose per day, which we're calling the average daily intake or chronic daily intake. Let's move on to slide 20, please. And this calculation involves both the chemical concentration that a receptor will be exposed to and various intake parameters. Slide 20 shows the basic algorithm that is used to compute the average daily intake, in which we're going to be calling the daily dose in our training session today. And it shows the relationship of the exposure parameters that are used as the terms in this equation. And this is just really a basic generalized equation. Other exposure terms can be added depending on your site and the exposures and receptors, or the equation can be modified based on the physical properties of the chemicals that are being evaluated at each site, or if a different pathway is assessed. This is just a general equation for purposes of an example during our module here. Now, you'll notice that the left side of this equation is highlighted because you're going to see this equation again in Module 2, and Bennett will illustrate in Module 2 how this algorithm can be modified and how simple things like a different approach to estimating the average body weight for adults can change the average daily dose. Let's move to slide 21, please. In the risk characterization step, the daily intake or dose from an exposure and the toxicity values that have been identified are combined to calculate the estimated risks and hazards from a site. The risks for carcinogenic chemicals are calculated by multiplying the average daily dose and the cancer slope factor. The resulting risk is expressed as a probability, that is, a 1 in a million chance or a 1 in a 100,000 chance of developing a cancer from that particular exposure. The effects from non-carcinogenic compounds are expressed by what is called a hazard quotient. And if you recall, the reference dose is really a threshold level for non-carcinogenic compounds. Therefore, the average daily dose for a non-carcinogenic compound is compared to this value in the form of a ratio in which the reference dose is in the denominator. If the average daily dose is less than the reference dose, then the hazard quotient or ratio is less than 1, and that indicates to you that there is little or no effect from an exposure from that particular compound at that site because the exposure dose is less than the reference dose. And finally, at this stage, All risk and hazard quotients are summed for all pathways for each receptor to determine the potential risk from receptors for this site. But it's important to note, too, that the carcinogenic risks represent only the incremental or excess probability or chance of developing a cancer that is above and beyond the probability of developing cancer without this exposure. And to put this in perspective, currently the background or probability of any adult developing cancer for any reason in the United States is somewhere between 1 in 2 and 1 in 3. And as exposures to our hazardous waste sites, we're usually talking about risk in the levels of 1 in a million to 1 in a thousand. Let's move on to slide 22, please. So you can see from the previous slides, there's room for many sources of variation in risk calculations and risk assessments. The same chemical can have a different toxicity value based on different sources and studies. Different agencies involved might approve using a different toxicity value for the same chemical. TCE is an example of a compound that has several different toxicity values that have been used by various agencies in the last few years. So again, this is where risk communication and clarity in risk assessments come into play between the different parties and people involved. Also, it's important to document all your exposure assumptions and as well as the limitations of the data that was used in both the dose and risk calculations. And as all these things vary from agency to agency, as well as the method used for calculating your average daily dose. Let's move on to slide 23. Now, we said in the beginning of Module 1 that we were going to look at screening levels more closely, so we're going to briefly revisit the chart from slide 13. And you can see from this chart that the screening levels define the beginning of the region where corrective action might be necessary. Almost all state and federal agencies publish some kind of guidance that usually contains a list or identifies a chemical concentration for which a compound below which they may require no additional action. These are usually called, they're not called screening levels, but they're generally called action levels, reportable levels, or even cleanup levels. And these values can vary greatly between EPA regions or from state to state or for the same chemical. They can even vary within a state under different regulatory programs. And it's because of these differences and the differences in programs that sometimes you have sites close to each other with the same contaminant, but often they have very different methods of remediation due to the differences in the cleanup levels under different programs. One site might require only monitoring while another require active remediation. Let's move on to slide 24. And screening levels can also be divided into two general categories, those that are risk-based and those that are non-risk-based. Risk-based screening levels are those that are derived using the available toxicity data, generic exposure assumptions, and a chosen risk level. Examples of risk-based screening levels are the EPA, well, there used to be the EPA Region 3 RBCs or Region 9 PRGs. Now there's a more comprehensive regional screening level list for the EPA that supersedes both of those, or the soil screening levels. A non-risk-based screening level can be published values that are set by each individual regulatory agency to be protective of human health, or things like background levels or analytical limits. The EPA MCLs are an example of a health protective value that is commonly used for a screening level. Sometimes you will use both types of screening levels at a site, too. In Module 3, we're going to illustrate a case study that did use both types of screening levels, both risk-based and non-risk-based levels, in their decision-making processes, as well as a case where screening levels were used as remediation levels. And both types of approaches were found to be acceptable by the regulatory agencies and stakeholders that were involved at each site. So that in both cases, you'll see that risk communication between all the parties led to the acceptance of the particular type of level and remediation approach at each site. Let's move on to slide 25. For risk-based screening levels, the same algorithms are used that we just reviewed for the exposure assessment in slide 21, but the terms have been rearranged to determine the concentration that will equate to a specific risk level. Slide 25 shows that by rearranging the risk equation from slide 21, the average daily dose is equal to the ratio of the risk level divided by the cancer slope factor. By substituting the exposure parameters used to calculate the average daily dose in the left side of the equation and using a specific risk level and toxicity value, we can solve for that chemical concentration. The resulting concentration is the risk-based screening level. In Module 2, Bennett will demonstrate how using the same compound and the same exposure parameters but with slightly different equations will affect the resulting screening levels for the same compound. Slide 26, please. And generally, site data is compared to screening levels by using one of two methods. There's a direct comparison of one sample result to the screening level, usually the maximum detected concentration from either a set of discrete samples or composite sample. The other method is a statistical comparison using the whole data set from the site. Generally, they calculate a 95% upper confidence limit of the mean or the average value of the data set and compare that number to the screening level. Some people feel that using the whole data set is more representative of site exposures, while other people feel that using the maximum detected concentration, which is really just one single data point from your site, is a more conservative and protective approach for the screening level step. And you have to remember the screening level step is really just the first step in the whole risk assessment, risk management process. So you start out with a broad general screening approach and then you narrow things down as you focus in on your, on whatever compounds are presenting a hazard at your site. Let's move on to slide 27, please. So let's, again, summarize briefly the value that screening levels provide. They provide a decision point for the risk management process. Can a site be eliminated? Does the site warrant further investigation or assessment? They can also be used to reduce the number of chemicals that need to be addressed by further evaluation or assessment. They allow you to focus your time and energy on the chemicals and pathways that do present the greatest risk at each site. Let's move on to slide 28. Now, we saw that screening levels are calculated or derived using generic exposures, assumptions, and parameters. In contrast, remediation levels are derived using site-specific data for the exposure parameters. And this is data that was developed during the risk assessment that you've done for your site, as well as approved and agreed upon target risk levels by all parties involved. And this risk level may be different for the remediation level than the risk level that was used to develop the screening level. Generally, screening levels are much more conservative than remediation levels because they are the initial step. And remediation levels also have to take into account the cost and practicability of whatever the selected corrective action is. The screening levels are used in the risk management process to move a site forward in the investigation process, while remediation levels are generally used to aid in the evaluation of the corrective action alternatives for the site and to determine site closeout. And remediation levels, of course, must be agreed upon by all parties involved. And again, that illustrates the importance of risk communication as an important factor in this whole process. Let's move on to slide 29, please. Risk management decisions involve many people with a variety of backgrounds and different levels of authority in the decision-making process. And risk assessments, as we know, generate a lot of specialized and technical data, especially these large and complex sites. And again, this is emphasizing the importance of communication between all parties, that it's the communication of all this specialized technical data needs to be done in a manner that is clear and transparent, as well as easy for everyone to understand and follow. In Module 3, we're going to illustrate the importance of risk communication between the public, the regulators, and the stakeholders, and also how risk communication can affect the development and outcome of a remediation level. And this brings us to slide 30, in which we're going to summarize the key challenges in risk assessment and risk management. Risk communication is really the biggest challenge, the one that we just discussed. Agreeing on acceptable levels of excess risk for a site is really always challenging. Also, obtaining a complete and adequate sampling data is a big challenge. And finally, recognizing the inconsistencies from state to state, region to region, in the methods used for risk assessment and risk management is a big challenge. People tend to think that everything's done the way they're used to, but when you work in the Southeast and then you start working in the Midwest, there's different procedures and different things have developed differently in each region. The question always comes up as, why is the level of a chemical acceptable in one area of the country and not in the other? And we're going to explore this last challenge further in Module 2. Now I'm going to turn the discussion back over to Juliana.
Thank you, Anna. On slide 31, we're going to take a short break for questions at this point. For our simulcast audience, you can use that question mark button at the top of the slide to send in your question. Our phone line audience, you are welcome to ask your own questions out loud. It is *7 to unmute your phone, and then state your name and location when asking a question. Do we have questions to start from our phone line audience? Remember, it's *7 to unmute. For the simulcast audience, it does take a couple of minutes for those questions to come through. You can use the question mark button at the top of the slide to send in your questions. While we're waiting for those questions to come through, Bennett, at the beginning you mentioned the additional training class provided by the risk team, and that's going to be offered later this month on April 27, and it's called the Use of Risk Assessment and Management of Contaminated Sites. Can you tell us a bit more about what's included in that class?
Yeah, I can. What we do is we focus on how risk assessment's actually used at sites. And we take one of the case studies that we have, and then we have four additional ones. I think we'll only present two additional ones, and we'll look at how management decisions were actually made at sites, and we'll take a look at those different situations. Then what we also do is we created hypothetical sites, and we sent those out to regulators and said, well, if you received data that looked like this, what would you do? So we kind of use a retrospective approach to see what was actually done, and then we use a prospective approach to try to see what regulators would do. And between those, we draw conclusions and we come up with a modified process, a set of recommendations that we hope would actually improve the way risk assessment and risk management is done at sites. And so I think the rubber will hit the road for a lot of people on that. It will really put things together between this presentation and that one.
Thank you. You can register for that training class from the ITRC website, or we'll show you a link at the end of today's class where you can register as well. A simulcast question from Jeff Gernid at KCI Technologies in Sparks, Maryland. What were the RBCs superseded by?
So the EPA has a new set of screening levels they call the RSLs, and what happened was they're basically the same as the PRGs and RBCs, but they have taken the place of the Region 3, Region 9, and Region 6 screening levels in all three, or really, I'm not sure if more than all three regions, but the EPA, it's just an EPA-wide kind of screening table.
Thank you. From Marcella Keenan at Carno Corner Bear in Chicago, Illinois. Can you further describe how reference dose is calculated?
Well, you know, that might be a question I'll throw to Bennett, since he has a lot more toxicology experience than I do.
At least in terms of the reference dose, what's typically done is that there will be a no observed effect exposure level, a NOEL, and based on how the dose response study was done, then a variety of safety factors would be incorporated, and that will give that'll give the reference dose, and then that's, as Anna pointed out, then that'll be divided by the average daily dose. But yeah, it's all part of doing that dose response study.
And one more question for this question and answer break. This is from Paula Kaufman at Emmacott in Chapman, New Jersey. Are risk-based screening levels often used as action levels or threshold action levels for perimeter monitoring locations? Do you have any guidance for resources on the selection of action levels that can be used as part of a site management plan during remediation activities?
Oh, I think that's going to be dependent entirely on the state and the program, the regulator for that program. And that's going to be, you know, specifically, you're going to have to specifically address that with whatever party is guiding your site investigation. But in my experience, I have seen certain cases where, especially to expedite a cleanup, that everyone agreed to use the screening levels for the cleanup levels. And, in fact, in the case study in Module 3, I think you'll see the same thing.
Thank you. We do want to go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break. We'll have another after the next couple of modules. If you have taken your phone off of mute, it is *6 to put the phone back on mute. Moving on to slide 32, I'll turn this presentation back over to Bennett Kotler at the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection. Bennett.
Thanks, Juliana. On slide 32, when the ITRC Risk Resources Team was first formed and we first met in 2003, we had a room full of state regulators and federal regulators, and we couldn't help it, but we immediately asked each other about two issues. And we asked each other, well, what values do you use for screening levels and action levels, right? That was exactly the question that I said wasn't the smartest question to ask, but you know, it just goes to show you, even regulators wanted to know that. And then the second thing we asked each other is, well, what approach do you use? What do you consider surface soil? And, you know, a whole series of questions. Well, we realized we didn't know the answers to them, so we undertook a survey to address these questions. And I'm going to present some of those results. In December of 2005, ITRC published the survey, and it's the same name as this module, Examination of Risk-Based Screening Values and Approaches of Selected States. Throughout the presentation, I'll refer to it as State Screening Values Document, and you can download a PDF of it for free at the ITRC website. Slide 33. In this module, I'll tell you about the results of the survey, and by the end of the module, you should be able to document differences in screening levels used by various U.S. states and determine the basis for how those levels were developed, or at least a subset of them. I'm going to spend the next set of slides, beginning with 34, describing the survey. On slide 34, the survey was based on 13 U.S. states, where 11 out of 13 states had a regulator as a member of the team. They were present in that room at that time that I mentioned, and they were interested. And that was terrific, because there's nothing better than speaking to a regulator or a member of an agency so that they can provide institutional knowledge that you may not necessarily get through something published or just by Googling their website. And it was also valuable to understand the basis or approach used by particular states. I'll also point out that 2 out of 13 states we included because a previous survey by a California-based nonprofit indicated that the states may have unique values. So we included those supposed outliers that might give us some additional insight. And yeah, there were a number of states and regions that we missed, although in the end, right now the team has a member from Region 10 from Alaska and from Region 2 from New Jersey. But I think the patterns that we saw are likely to be replicated. There's no reason to think that they won't be replicated in other EPA regions. So we'll show you what we have. On slide 35, we, as part of our survey, we asked regulators about values and approaches used for five particular chemicals that were simply based on what the regulators were interested in and what they said was prevalent at their sites. On slide 36, we asked for information about three different exposure routes, three receptors, and four different environmental media. And the interesting thing was that even at this stage, we started finding differences between the states. Some states had values for other receptors for commercial workers that were handled differently among the states. Arkansas equated commercial and residential adults. Other ones may have equated commercial with industrial exposure. Kentucky had a set of values for outdoor workers that no other state had, and Michigan also developed a set of values for underground utility workers that modeled exposure to contaminated groundwater at higher than quote unquote normal rates. So yeah, pretty interesting to see U.S. federalism seeping into science, how the science is done in different states. And again, we kind of see that it's actually federalism is set up in how U.S. EPA has states setting target risk levels, and you can see that on slide 37. As Anna noted, the importance of both carcinogens and non-carcinogens, we asked the states for those data. And U.S. EPA guidance says that U.S. states can select from a range of target excess risk levels and hazard quotients. So many states choose a target risk level of 1 times 10 to the minus 6. It's very conservative, but they don't have to. Michigan, for instance, has a target level of 1 times 10 to the minus 5. That effectively sets carcinogen screening levels tenfold higher than the majority of states that are using 1 times 10 to the minus 6. Same is true with hazard quotients. Many states select a hazard quotient equal to 1, but Georgia has gone a different way. It chooses a hazard quotient of 0.1. California chooses 0.2. In the case of Georgia, with the 0.1 hazard quotient, it effectively sets the screening level 10 times lower, 10 times more conservative than the majority of the states. Now, as I said in the introduction, if you look at the numbers don't speak for themselves, so we don't know why. So that needs to be documented in whatever reports you're putting out, or hopefully the states will do it. But as we were putting together the survey, luckily we had a regulator from Georgia in the room, and I got to ask Jim what's going on, and he said that it was based on U.S. EPA Region 4 risk-based concentration screening guidance, which was available at that time, which presumed additivity of risk contaminant concern. Okay, that's a reasonable idea of and reasonable explanation for why Georgia would do that. So, again, it's important that that basis be there, even so we just know if there's a scientific or non-scientific reason for what the decisions are. Well, as part of this study, we normalized the screening levels to target risks of 1 times 10 to the minus 6 for carcinogens, and for non-carcinogens, we set the hazard quotients equal to 1. So, on slide 38, between all the compounds and exposure scenarios and carcinogens and non-carcinogens and 13 U.S. states, we amassed a total of 650 screening values. In addition, we collected 13 exposure parameters from the 13 states. What are the parameters that the states are including in their algorithms to come up with the doses, like the average daily doses that Anna was speaking about. And lastly, as part of our survey, we also collected non-quantitative information as part of the survey. And if you really want to see a group of regulators and risk assessors squirm, ask them to come up with a definition of hotspot or even screening value. I mean, those non-quantitative information points, you know, were strangely difficult to define, or at least strangely difficult to end up with one definition. We sort of take that for granted. But ultimately, that information led us to refine the survey, because even when we started out, we were asking for cleanup values, and we realized that states don't publish the cleanup values. Those tend to be determined on a site-by-site basis. It's the screening values that the states publish, those conservative, generic values. So we, you know, like most things, we learned along the way, too, or surely firmed up our understanding. On slide 39, I'd like to start presenting some of the results that I have, and I'm not going to present them all. By all means, download the document from the ITRC website, the state screening values document, and you can see that for a variety of compounds. Okay, on slide 39, you can see the groundwater screening values for TCE that are used by 13 states. States colored blue have the same value. And you can see on the x-axis that the concentration is in a log scale, and on the y-axis you can see the different states. Well, you can see a lot of blue. 10 out of 13 U.S. states have identical groundwater screening values for TCE. Pretty surprising, because we think that, you know, the U.S. states are so different from each other. And, you know, if you like, you can think of California and Nevada in a steel cage together. But what do you know? They all have the same 5 microgram per liter screening value. Those of you who are familiar with U.S. federal MCLs will recognize that. Those maximum contaminant levels that are a part of drinking water standards. So it looks like many states adopted that value, and the truth be told, many states lack the resources to conduct their own risk assessments, so why not use a perfectly good number, even though it's for drinking water. Most of us are screening groundwater, but, you know, okay, it's still going to be a conservative screening value for us. But we should take note that there are those three states, Florida, Georgia, and Kentucky, that have different values, and I colored those in green. And just by looking at this figure, we can't tell the reason. So let's move on and see if looking at additional data reveals any clues. And on slide 40, you can see the same compound, TCE, but now we're looking at the soil screening values. Concentrations are on a log scale, and notice the scale's gotten bigger, and on the y-axis we have the states. And the states that are colored blue have the same value, and we see much less blue, where only 6 out of 13 states use the same screening value for TCE. So we see greater variation compared to the TCE screening values in groundwater. Perhaps that's due to the absence of a federal drinking water MCL for soil. Maybe it's due to the environmental chemistry of a volatile organic compound such as TCE in soil in contrast to water. And then, you know, I should point out, if you look at the state of Michigan, it's way up there. What Michigan has decided to use is a soil saturation concentration for TCE in soil. And then I'd like to point out again, among those states with unique values, Florida appears for a second time. And on slide 41, I look at another soil screening value. This one's for benzoapyrene, very different compound than TCE. And In this particular case, the x-axis, you see the concentrations in a log value, much narrower. And we see in this case that there's more agreement than previously. So maybe it's due to the low volatility of benzoate-pyrene. But I'd also like to point out, among those green states, those states with unique values, Florida has appeared for a third time. So we're going to take note of that, and later in this presentation, we're going to focus on Florida because it seems to be doing some unique things. On slide 42, we'll just have a median summary of what I've just presented, and that's that it's pretty easy to document, you know, from 46 to 76% of the states had identical screening values depending on the compound and the environmental medium. And again, in the state screening values document, we detail the differences for all five chemicals. And the same effort could be done for more compounds, but here's our mascot encouraging us to auger down and do the hard work to try to determine the basis for these differences. And in some ways that's difficult because the documentation may not accompany the final published values and everybody just gloms on to big tables with numbers. And, you know, we don't do the hard work of always asking, well, where did that number come from? So this is what we're going to do for the rest of this module is try to figure out, well, where did some of these numbers come from? On slide 43, one way to understand the basis for screening values is to note the source. As I said, all U.S. states adopt federal MCLs when they're available. But what happens when there is none? Well, at the time that we did this, the different U.S. EPA regional offices were not in harmony with each other. And there were a number of states that, even though they weren't in U.S. EPA Region 9, they tended to use those PRGs, preliminary remediation goals. And they were Alabama, Georgia, Kentucky, Nevada, South Carolina, Tennessee. Two other states, they went a different way. They use EPA Region 6. As Anna mentioned in response to the question, now that there are regional screening levels, this concern that previously haunted us and people doing risk assessments and working with risk assessors, this is one less concern that we'll likely have to worry about. But nonetheless, there's still another way. And that is that there are those states out there, such as California, Colorado, Florida, Kansas, and Michigan, that have state-derived numbers. They have the resources, they have the legislative mandate, and they go their own way. Well, because Florida is among those states, and it had unique values in those three figures I showed, we're going to look at that again, and we're going to use that as a proxy and as something, as a state indicative of what happens with these state-derived values. And then I'd also throw out there, too, even though states might have the same number, they might use them differently. Okay, on slide 44, if you recall from Anna's presentation in Module 1, exposure assessment is one of the four components of a risk evaluation. So if what we're finding is that there's variation in the screening value, it's logical to assume that the exposure assessment is responsible for some of the variation. So what you see in this figure is what we try to do is isolate the exposure assumptions to investigate one possible source of variation in the screening value. Exposure is expressed as average daily dose, and Anna explained that. But it also includes a toxicity assessment, and Anna explained, again, for carcinogens, that's a cancer slope factor for the case of carcinogens. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to get that out, that confound that additional source of variation and normalize all of these daily doses so that all we're looking at is, well, we're really asking the question of what dose are states assuming exposed populations are receiving. So that's what we did. We assumed that all the slope factors and all the reference doses are all equal to one. And we got them out of there, and so we're only going to look at exposure. So for the rest of this module, keep in mind that even though I'm calling it ADD, it's always normalized, a normalized average daily dose, and missing the consideration of chemical concentration or toxicity. Okay, well, after all that buildup, if we look at the doses that states are assuming as part of their algorithms, we see 7 out of 13 states have identical values, but once again, Florida and other states have unique values. Okay, so in slide 45, I want to dig into this algorithm for average oral daily dose and see what's packed in there. The algorithm that you see, it was used by Florida for both carcinogens and non-carcinogens. And now as we're digging down into this, if there's variation between Florida's average oral daily dose and some other states, then the source must lie somewhere here in the exposure assumptions that are into this algorithm. You can see several terms in the equation, but what we're going to do is we're only going to focus down on one of those parameters, and we're just going to focus on body weight. If you download the full state screening values document from the ITRC website, on page 29 and 30, you can see these two tables, table 6 and 7, and they list those 13 exposure parameters for the 13 states. Table 6 does it for carcinogens. Table 7 does it for non-carcinogens. So, yeah, there's a lot of information there in that one table, imagining as you go from state to state. So if we look at body weight, beginning on slide 46, U.S. states that base risk assessments on U.S. EPA's 1997 Exposure Factors Handbook, they evaluate the risk of exposure to contaminants to populations of adults, and those adults are assumed to weigh 70 kilograms. And again, we're looking at populations, so I probably show the two most extreme individuals in among the spectrum of weights in a population. Now, that number, 70 kilograms, was based on real data. It was a National Center for Health Statistics survey that was done in 1987, and it's a conservative estimate of body weight for most individuals, and that's from the age of 7 on up to 70. We'll get to the children in a minute. Now we're probably assuming, wow, you know, the smaller individual is going to get a higher dose. That's no good for him. If someone's larger, then they're going to get a lower dose. But the truth is that we don't know what the exposure parameters are, even for these individuals. For the other parameters, are they normal? Are they upper bound? So what typically happens is there's for exposure parameters such as body weight, US EPA and the states tend to assume central tendencies for those. But for duration and frequency, like 30 years of exposure to a carcinogen, that's an upper bound assumption. So when you take these things together, risk assessments are conservative, and they are intended to account for uncertainty and protect adults for variability. Even if that comes from pharmacokinetic considerations and age and physiological state. On slide 47, well, we need to keep in mind that there are also children that are going to be exposed, and for all their years, from 0 to 6 years, they're assumed to be 15 kilograms. I'm hoping my daughter's going to turn 3, and she's almost there. She's 27 and a half pounds, so not quite, but we're getting there. But there is a problem, you know, even assuming that children are getting exposed. What happens if we have 30 years of exposure, but it spans childhood and adulthood? So given two broad groups, U.S. states age adjust exposure parameters such as body weight. Slide 48. Age adjustment of exposure parameters is valuable because it better represents possible exposure scenarios to populations. On slide 49, we can take a look and we can see how the state of Florida handles age adjustment of body weight. And the data were valid at the time that we conducted our survey in 2003. In the above equation, you can see that Florida adjusts body weight by multiplying body weight by the number of years spent as a child, and then adds that to the body weight of an adult multiplied by the number of years spent as an adult. And then this value is divided by the total number of years of exposure. On slide 50, you can see what value we get when we insert values for each of those parameters in. And you can see we obtain 59 kilograms. That's the age-adjusted body weight term that Florida used in its exposure algorithms at the time of the study. On slide 51, as we're publishing this study, in February of 2005, our regulator from Florida says, sorry, everyone, we've just updated our cleanup target levels. And Florida did this in response to stakeholder input. And stakeholders didn't like the idea of too broad groups of adults and children and the apparent lack of actual data. So Florida developed more representative numbers. And this goes back to my point of don't worry about the numbers, you can always look them up and they're going to change on you. So Florida used actual and updated body weights from a subsequent National Center for Health Statistics survey, and data from yearly increments from age 1 to 31 were averaged to represent an aggregate resident. And Florida obtained an average body weight value of 51.9 kilograms rather than 59 kilograms that it previously assumed, and in fact other states that used US EPA Region 9 data at the time also used. So to reiterate, Florida is using a different and if not better representation of exposed population values than the average of two broad age intervals. The underlying assumptions regarding risk are unchanged, and Florida, having the resources and the stakeholder incentive, parted ways with US EPA regional offices when able to improve this component of exposure assessments. And note that the use of 51.9 kilogram body weight is lower than the 59 kilogram body weight. So the lower body weight assumption is it works out in the calculations that there's a higher dose being assumed that populations are being exposed to. And we'll see that has consequences when determining a screening value. On slide 52, to summarize what we've seen at this point, we not only saw that there are two different ways to do age adjustments, and in fact by the same state, now want to know, can we incorporate an age-adjusted value into exposure algorithms differently? And there's no reason why not. So what we're going to do now is compare Florida to US EPA Region 9 and its preliminary remediation goals. The reason we're using Florida is it had a unique value. It represents state-derived ones. And at the time we did the study, US EPA Region 9 seemed to be the most popular one. So the popular of the US EPA regions. So that way we can refer to many states by referring to one set of numbers. On slide 53, you can see two different algorithms for calculating normalized average oral daily dose for both carcinogens and non-carcinogens. At the top of the slide, you can see Florida's algorithm, and note that the age-adjusted body weight is in the denominator of the equation, and this explains why lowering the body weight, as we've slowly seen has happened to these numbers, it's gone from 70 to 59 to 52, that leads to a higher dose calculated. Well, in this equation, we also see an ingestion term in the numerator. At the bottom of the slide, which was US EPA Region 9 at that time, we don't see an ingestion rate, but we see an age-adjusted ingestion factor. We also don't see body weight. Well, let's take a look at that age-adjusted ingestion factor, and you can do that on slide 54. US EPA calculated one age-adjusted soil ingestion factor for a child, and then calculated a second factor for adults, and then added the two to represent the total 30 years of soil ingestion. And notice that the body weight term is tucked into that factor, making it different than a rate. And on slide 55, we take another look at the algorithms for normalized average oral daily dose. We see in blue on the right a set of parameters that are identical for both US EPA and for Florida. On the left, we see three parameters that Florida handled separately, and then we can see that they are incorporated by US EPA into the soil ingestion factor, and all of that's in red on the left side. Well, I'd like to insert values into each of those parameters. On slide 56, you can see that. On blue on the right, you see identical values. You see a value of 1 for the fraction of soil absorption efficiency into the body. You can see 350 days per year, which is the exposure frequency. And then you can see the average lifetime exposure of 70 years, 25,550 days in the denominator. On the red on the bottom, in left, is the age-adjusted soil ingestion factor. Although it's similar in magnitude to the soil ingestion rate in the equation at the top of the slide, the units are different, so we've got apples and oranges. And then take a look in green in the top equation are two parameters that remain split out from the top equation. And these parameters insert a value of 30 59ths, nearly one-half, into Florida's algorithm. So we would expect that Florida's average oral daily dose is about half of that of US EPA Region 9's PRGs that were calculated at that time. On slide 57, I complete the calculation for Florida at the top of the previous slide, and we obtain an average oral daily dose of 0.836 milligrams per kilogram day for state of Florida. Well, on slide 58, I show that figure that I started this all out on slide 44 at the very start of this discussion, where we take another look at the normalized oral average daily dose for carcinogens. And there goes Florida with 0.836. All the blue states have the same values. And what do you know? Florida's average oral daily dose is about half of those US EPA Region 9 PRGs. You should take note that Kansas and Michigan also have average oral daily doses that are about half of that of US EPA Region 9. Well, but let's – now we're working our way back out of our monitoring well, and let's try to predict what about the screening value, because that's, I guess, the thing that we're concerned about. So we have these doses for some states that are half that. Well, now if you think about it, to be protective, if you're assuming a population is only getting half the dose, then you don't have to have as high of a screening value to have the same risk. So let's take a look at that in slide 59, looking at the screening values for arsenic, which is one compound that's part of the focus for Module 3. Blue states reference the US EPA Region 9 screening value at the time, which was 0.39. Florida's screening value at the time we conducted our survey was 0.8, approximately two and a half times higher than these states, so it worked. Kansas and Michigan in the previous slide, which assumed lower average oral daily doses, they have higher screening values, and they refer to different things. Some they also refer to background. That's also one of the issues. So the really amazing thing is that we're able to predict Florida's value would be 2.5 times a US EPA value without consideration. Remember, there's dermal and inhalation exposure. So that just goes to show you how dominant oral exposure is in these calculations of lifetime average daily doses. Now, interestingly, Florida was at it again. As we're completing this presentation, Florida changed its screening value. It raised it further. They got more information. They reduced uncertainty, and they took a look at bioavailability of arsenic. So now, what you'll see if you work in Florida is their state screening value for arsenic is 2.1 milligrams. Nonetheless, this supports one of the trends that we've been seeing is that states with their own resources likely go their own way, and as you reduce uncertainty, you can change values and still be protective because you know more. The only reason why we use these wildly conservative values of 10 to the minus 6 or 10 to the minus 5, depending on the mandate of the state, is because of the uncertainty. But if you knew where the exposure was, you could probably be less conservative. So in slide 60, in conclusion, we saw a limited number of differences in part because many states rely on US EPA values. Despite a three-order of magnitude variation for TCE in soil, even those numbers are conservative. As Anna noted in Module 1, the background level of cancer is 1 in 2, 1 in 3. And, again, our discussions are 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 1,000,000. At the time, the US EPA values varied between regional offices. And luckily now with the establishment of the regional screening values, we have this consideration off the table that US EPA is now speaking with one voice. But the refinement of values by individual states, that results in the highest amount of variation. On slide 61, although not included in this presentation, we noted in our survey, and you can see that in the document, that even with the same screening values, different legislative mandates influence how the data are used. The idea of screening, should we use it, a screening value as a screening value, or are we allowed to use it as a cleanup value? Well, I'll also point that out in one of our case studies in our last module. Different agencies have different definitions of parameters, and that can also be a source of differences despite having the same screening value. And additional technical considerations may obscure the origin and the intended use of screening values. So in the end, transparency to the regulated community would be important so that we know how values are intended to be used. Stakeholders may challenge regulators about the variation that they observe from state to state, but Florida benefited from that kind of input, and ultimately it did publish the basis for its values. On slide 62, because of the limited authority of, you know, the ITRC and our group, we don't want to second guess the legislative intent of environmental laws in different states. So we don't advocate for one particular approach to risk-based screening of soil, but we appreciate US EPA harmonizing. The group does advocate for the sake of transparency that you publish the basis of the criteria and underlying assumptions, publish the intended application, and provide training and communication tools. And lastly, in slide 63, the group considered additional work, say additional media and pathways, or maybe additional states, maybe looking at federal agencies and seeing what they do. But what the group did do is we focused on the derivation and application of screening values, focusing on the collection and use of site-specific data, and risk-based cleanup goals and remedy selection, and that's really the basis of our second document and that second training program we have coming up at the end of the month. So with that, I'd like to turn our program over to Juliana.
Thank you, Bennett. We're going to take another break for questions. For our simulcast audience, it's that question mark button at the top of the slide that's going to allow you to send in questions. For our phone line audience, you are welcome to ask questions out loud. It's *7 to unmute the phone so that you can ask questions. And please state your name and location when you're asking your question. We have a simulcast question that asks that we please define excess risk.
Well, as we've noted, that there is a background. Well, I guess I've been using excess risk to refer to excess cancer risk. So noting that there's a background level of risk of cancer from a variety of different causes, then the calculations that are used, the target risk levels, are really in excess of that risk and those levels by EPA and can vary from 1 × 10⁻⁴, 1 in 1,000, to 1 × 10⁻⁶ excess risk of cancer to a population of 1 million individuals from exposure to these particular compounds, but noting that, yeah, there is a background occurrence of cancer that people will likely be exposed to.
Thank you. A simulcast question from Kathleen Siebenman at U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Sacramento. This we received after the first module. Based on information provided so far and an introduction to the remedial levels, it appears that it's possible that your initial risk assessment using screening levels may indicate that an action is required, yet a site concentration may not exceed the negotiated remedial levels. Would this mean that no remediation actually necessary?
I can address that. Well, that may be, again, noting that the screening is done with conservative default assumptions that are not specific to the site. As more information is developed, as an initial site conceptual model for a site, which would include the exposure pathways if you're interested in doing a risk assessment and other toxicological assessments, as you further refine that, then you might get more information, and so your negotiated cleanup level may not need to be as conservative, or may not need to address those initial assumptions. I mean, one of the assumptions is uniform exposure to a contaminant, and that's rarely true. So that is true, that in, that your cleanup levels will likely be different and less conservative than the information you developed at the very start of your investigation.
Thank you. For our phone line audience, remember *7 to unmute and state your name and location. Do we have any questions from our phone line audience? A question from Diego Garcia at CIS in Bogota, Colombia. What is the unit of the average daily dose?
That is going to be, milligram, I wanted to say milligrams per kilogram per day, but I think there must be a time component in that as well, because it's also based on the number of years of exposure.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break and move on to the next module of the training class. Before we do, I do want to remind everyone to fill out the feedback form at the end of today's training class. We do use that information. And from the last page, there's a link that will allow you to access the feedback form so that we can get your feedback. That's information we do use. On slide 65, we'll move on to Module 3 of today's training class, and I will turn it over to Anna Butler of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Anna?
Thank you, Juliana. Right, in Module 1, we reviewed some of the basic principles of site characterization and risk assessment, and then in Module 2, Bennett just talked about how screening levels may be similar among some states and different in others, and how these differences can develop. Again, how many times have we asked ourselves or heard the question, why is the cleanup number for Compound X different from my site than for that site over there across the street or across the state line? In Module 3, we're going to continue to dig deeper into this question. To do this, we will examine two case studies, and we're going to be looking in these case studies specifically at how the screening numbers or levels and site-specific risk assessments were used in the risk management process to establish cleanup levels or numbers at these sites. We are going to show the importance of transparency and understanding the basis of the cleanup goals or cleanup levels that were agreed upon at each site, as well as how they were applied. Many times we see that cleanup levels or numbers differ for the same chemical on a similar site, as we just mentioned. And as we dig deeper into how these cleanup numbers or levels are developed and how they're applied, we can see that things like site history, local conditions, and land use, as well as the more scientific aspects of the risk assessment that we've been discussing in these last two modules, are used in evaluating the remedial level, cleanup levels, and also the technology that's used is going to determine the type of cleanup level that's going to be agreed upon at a site. And that all affects the final number that's used for a cleanup level. Let's move on to slide 66, please. Now, to help us focus on where to dig in our quest to answer these questions about the difference in cleanup levels existing for the same contaminant, the specific objectives we're going to discuss in this module are identified on this slide. And to achieve these objectives, we're going to present two case studies during this module showing two different ways that cleanup levels were derived, two different ways in how the sampling approaches were used at the site, and how the cleanup criteria were used and applied at these sites in different ways. And you'll see that both sites and the different ways that these things were used are valid because they're based on the specific circumstances and the specific compound and future land use at each site. And we're going to look at the site-specific sampling approaches for each site and the screening levels, how they were used in the sampling, and how the risk assessments were used at each different site for making decisions about the remediation levels. The goal is to let these case studies illustrate the story of how these risk-based criteria were integrated into the risk management decisions about the remediation cleanup process at each site. Let's move on to slide 67. As Bennett discussed in Module 2, there are many similarities as well as differences among the states and the EPA regions in developing and applying screening levels. The state surveys that the risk team did that Bennett mentioned in Module 2 showed the connection between sampling, risk analysis, and remediation is often unclear and unpredictable. And one of the primary recommendations from the report that this training class is based on and that you can download from the ITRC website is to make the evaluation decision-making process transparent to the reviewers so that they have a clear understanding of how these cleanup levels are derived and why and how they apply to that specific site. To illustrate this, the remediation risk assessment remediation team embarked on the case studies project that examined 6 to 8 site cleanups from various areas of the United States, compare the approaches used in collecting the information to evaluate the sites, and how the screening levels were used for making the site decisions, how and when site-specific risk assessment was used, or if it was used, and how the cleanup levels were developed. And for more information on these additional sites, you can actually download or obtain a copy of the document and read about that. For our purposes today, we're only going to look at two of these case studies. Slide 68, please. And to facilitate the comparison of these cases, the Risk Assessment Resource Team sent out a questionnaire called the Space Case Study Questionnaire, as Bennett had mentioned, to focus the write-up and to focus the information we were going to obtain from each of these case studies. The topics of the questionnaire are identified on this slide here. And that, again, the purpose of that was to make it easy to compare the same thing from each case study. Now, as we move on to slide 69, and you'll recognize this slide because you just saw it in module 1, and we're using it here again just to set the stage to see how risk-based criteria were used in making site-specific risk management decisions. And this slide illustrates or presents it shows you that risk managers have more to consider in making decisions than just risk assessment or just hard numbers. Let's move on to slide 70, please. Now, the two case studies we're going to identify in this module are located at opposite sides of the country, and you can see their locations are shown on this map in slide 70. The sites are the Spring Valley site located in Washington, D.C., and the Evergreen site located on the Fort Lewis Army Base near the city of Tacoma in Washington State. Some of you may be familiar if you live in the Northeast area with the Spring Valley site. Let's move on to slide 71, please. The Spring Valley site is the first case study we'll look at, and the Spring Valley site involved a 600-acre former military site that was used during World War I. The site was located in what was then the rural outskirts of Washington, D.C., and the investigation and remediation at the site is being conducted currently by the Baltimore District of the Army Corps of Engineers and is under the oversight of both federal and local agencies. Let's move on to slide 72. This facility was used for the testing of explosives and firing of mortars and rockets that contained chemical warfare agents that were commonly used during World War I. And following World War I, the site was thought to be cleaned up and was returned to the pre-World War I landowners for their use. And since that time in 1921, the area has been extensively redeveloped and now houses a university, many commercial enterprises, and well over 1,100 homes. Slide 73, please. And slide 73 just shows some historic pictures of the Spring Valley area when it was in use as a chemical warfare testing site. Note the smoke plumes and the weapon launchers, as well as the personal protective gear that are worn by the soldiers as they stand being exposed to the chemicals they're testing. Let's move on to slide 74. In 1993, a utility contractor uncovered buried ordnance as they were redeveloping part of the site, and a full remediation investigation was conducted over the area that was then believed to comprise the entire area of the Spring Valley site within the FUD's boundary, the former utilized defense site boundary. The initial investigation focused on areas that were thought to be where the mortars were made, where they were stored, launched, or exploded, and the sampling strategies used at that time was based on investigating the entire site. The goal at that time was to identify the chemicals of potential concern for that site and as well as areas of larger concern to be investigated further. The sampling locations were based on the historic photos and maps from the World War I training area, along with projections of where along the ground surface was during World War I. That is, you know, before grading and redeveloped changed the topography of the area. And the sample density at the time was low because the purpose of the sampling was just to identify areas of concern for further assessment and possible remediation. At that time, in 1993, a background assessment was also done to determine if the site concentrations for metals exceeded the background levels. 42 background samples were collected from unaffected native soils in the Spring Valley area. Arsenic, which was probably the result of lewisite, a chemical warfare compound, lewisite degradation, was the only metal that exceeded the background concentrations from this study. Of course, there were other COPCs identified at the Spring Valley site, but not metals. And our purpose is here today, we're just going to focus on the arsenic in the soil, just to illustrate the topics that we want to illustrate as far as risk assessment and screening levels and remediation levels. And the background study found that background arsenic concentrations range from 0.9 to 18 milligrams per kilogram. And the background concentration, the concentration of arsenic that was chosen to use as a background concentration, which was used for a screening level, was 12.6 milligrams per kilogram. And that represented the 95th percentile of the background sample data. So this was one of the screening levels that they developed for their site study, and site data is screened against the background level to determine whether or not it was naturally occurring or if it was possibly a result of the World War I chemical compounds. And if it was lower, then arsenic was not a concern in that area. If it was higher, then they went and did further investigation and further analysis. And also in 1995, a comprehensive site-wide risk assessment was performed in the Spring Valley area that found arsenic levels exceeded the health protective levels for arsenic at that time. Let's move to slide 75, please. So following the site-wide investigation, there were many discussions were held about how to proceed with the cleanup, as this is a large site and it had many complications, given especially with the extensive redevelopment of the original site. So as a result of all these discussions, in 1997, the investigation focus shifted from the general site-wide characterization to identifying areas that needed remediation on a more individual level, and they decided to use the individual lot, the individual landowner lot for the exposure area instead of the exposure area as the whole site. And the lots were identified as either being one or two areas within the active test area where the chemical warfare agents were first fired and tested, or adjacent to the active test area. And these lots were lots that could have received fallout from the rocket firing or explosions or a misfire or something like that. And these areas included over 1,100 homes and over 300 non-residential lots. And the important thing to note about this is that they shifted the exposure area from a site-wide area to individual lot size. And the areas for potential remediation were delineated based on the background concentration of arsenic, the 12.6 milligrams per kilogram. And this was used as the initial screening criteria rather than the health protective levels, because the carcinogenic health protective level was well below all the background levels found for arsenic in this area. At that time, the Region 3 RBCs were the screening level used, risk-based screening level that was being used in this area, and the RBC carcinogenic screening level for arsenic was 0.43 milligrams per kilogram, which was lower than every single background concentration detected at Spring Valley. So they decided to screen out everything that was below the background level as the first initial screening step in their investigation at each lot. Let's move on to slide 76, please. So this slide shows the active area and adjacent to active area strategies for sampling. The lots in the adjacent active area were divided into 2-acre areas, and random samples were collected on each half of the lot and composited for their analysis. And then they would get 2 sample results for each lot. Lots in the active area were divided into 4 equal parts, with the random samples collected in each of the 4 areas and then composited to yield 1 sample results per area or 4 per lot. If the lot was greater than a half acre, then the lot was broken into multiple 1/2 acre plots and divided equally for to get an appropriate sample scheme. Then the number of random gram samples to be composited was determined in each divided area so that a circular hot spot with a contaminant radius of 10 feet would be likely to be detected. And a hot spot, in their definition, was a small area of potentially high contamination that could be cause exposure of concern. So they compared all of these results, all the composite sample results were compared to the 12.6 milligram per kilogram background screening level, and things that were above this triggered additional sampling to define any potential remover areas. Let's move on to slide 77, please. Now, 77 shows you how they would sample the next step. This is the sampling scheme for those lots that had background levels, had arsenic concentrations that exceeded the background level. So if that happened, then the lot was divided into 20 feet by 20 feet grids to use to sample the whole property. And the sample was collected from the center of the grid. If the grid center was inaccessible due to, say, a house, tree, or patio, then the sample was collected from somewhere else in the grid as close as they could. And so you'll see in the slide 77, the small black dots show you the original sample locations from the random composite sampling, and then the green ones would be the samples collected from the center of the grid. Let's move on to slide 78. And this just shows you the results of a grid sampling at one property where three out of the four composite samples exceeded the background levels. Let's move on to slide 79, please. And after all this background screening and sampling, composite sampling and grid sampling was conducted, extensive community meetings were held for the purposes of risk communication. And the property owners at this time had major input in determining what the cleanup criteria would be. Ultimately, the cleanup criteria was set at 20 milligrams per kilogram in the accessible areas and 43 milligrams per kilogram in areas that were difficult to access, such as the wooded land. The 43 milligram per kilogram goal was used only with the property owner's consent. That is, they would probably clean up to 20 unless the property owner consented to have the higher cleanup level to prevent excessive excavation in areas that they agreed or did not want to have the excavation occur. And you'll notice that the 20 milligram per kilogram is higher than the background level and much higher than the 0.43 carcinogenic screening value, and that's because arsenic is one of the compounds that has two types of toxicity, carcinogenic and non-carcinogenic characteristics, and the cleanup level came from the non-carcinogenic screening value that was in effect at the time, which I don't really remember what the Region 3 RBC was, but the TRG used to be 22 milligrams per kilogram. And so all the risk communications and meetings and things that were held resulted in this 20 milligram per kilogram being agreed upon to be the cleanup level for arsenic in the Spring Valley. And the map in slide 79 shows a typical residential parcel that was sampled and determined to need remediation. And then, so the green hatched areas show the initial excavation areas where, in which they removed the top 2 feet of soil. And then they would take confirmation samples from the floor and sidewalls of the excavation. And if it still exceeded the 20 milligram per kilogram, then further soils were excavated and further confirmation samples were collected until the areas were below the cleanup standard. Let's move on to slide 80, please. Now, slide 80 illustrates the progression of the different cleanup criteria used at the Spring Valley site. 0.43 milligrams per kilogram was the calculated risk-based screening level for a 10 to the minus 6 incremental potential cancer risk from exposure to arsenic in soil using a residential exposure criteria, this generic residential exposure criteria with 30 years of lifetime exposure that was established by the EPA Region 3 at that time. And again, you can note that this level is much less than most background concentrations of arsenic around the world or in our country. The 12.6 milligram per kilogram number represents the 95th percentile of the 42 background sample results for arsenic concentrations. And after extensive and public involvement resulted in the establishment of the cleanup goal of 20 milligrams per kilogram for the exposed soils that could be excavated and 43 milligrams per kilogram for areas where removal was more difficult. And one thing that you want to note, if you remember the ratios we talked about in number one, the 20 milligrams per kilogram was close to a hazard quotient of 1, but is slightly less than 1. And then 43 milligrams per kilogram represents the estimated 10 to the minus 4 incremental potential cancer risk, or the upper end of EPA considers to be acceptable excess cancer risk. Let's move to slide 81. In slide 81, you'll again recognize the chart for the risk management spectrum that we saw in module 1. And if we apply this spectrum to the Spring Valley site, we can see that the Spring Valley site started with a health protective screening level on the left of 0.43, established by the U.S. EPA Region 3. And because this level is below background, they moved to the right and established a screening level for the background concentration of arsenic at 12.6 to delineate potential removal areas. Then the risk management decision process moved again to the right to establish a site-specific remediation goal of 20 milligrams per kilogram for the accessible areas based on the consensus of all stakeholders and parties involved. In addition, a maximum concentration was established for the inaccessible areas of 43 milligrams per kilogram. So that concludes our presentation for the Spring Valley case study, and now I'd like to turn the talk over to Bennett for the presentation of the second case study.
Thanks, Anna. On slide 82, you can see that the second case study is the Evergreen Firing Range at Fort Lewis, Washington, and that is an active military base located near Tacoma, Washington, and the particular site was used as a firing range for many years. And in the 1990s, the Army decided to close and clean up the firing range with the intent of building military housing. The Evergreen Firing Range on slide 83, you can see, was used to train soldiers to gain experience in moving under live fire in combat situations. And the graphic shows the general layout of the firing range. As seen in the photo, soldiers crept through the range while machine guns sprayed bullets above them and explosives were detonated around them. In the figure, the word gun signifies the location of the fixed machine guns. The word pyro shows the location of craters where explosives were detonated. And so machine gun bullets were shot into an earthen berm located about 300 feet from the machine gun firing range. And that impact berm was 40 feet high, 40 feet long, and 100 feet wide at its base. And that's going to be the focus of what we're going to look at. On slide 84, you can see an actual historical photo of the firing range. And again, you can see that berm in the upper portion of the photo. On slide 85, you can see that the triad approach was used for investigating and remediating the site. The triad approach uses the collection of real-time data to evaluate contaminant concentrations in the field. It involves systematic planning as to the data, what data you're going to go out and collect, what data, and how are you going to process the data, all as a part of flexibility in determining what to do at a site, or flexibility surely in sampling and making a set of decisions that have all been worked out as part of systematic planning. So that was the first creative thing that was done on the site, was to acquire real-time data. And a second interesting thing that was done was that, the data that were collected were validated by laboratory analyses, but I guess the interesting part that I want to get to is on slide 86 was the selection of the cleanup goal. Well, we had a variety of different choices at this particular site. 50 milligrams per kilogram at the top of the slide was the detection limit for using the XRF. It's also a screening level for ecological assessment used by Washington State. 250 milligrams per kilogram was the Washington State Human Health Protection screening level. 400 milligrams per kilogram was US EPA region screening level as part of the PRGs, and then there's also a number of 1,000 that could possibly be used. In this particular concern, because they're looking for lead, background was not an issue. So the interesting thing that was done was that they used the screening level for cleanup of the site. That way they are using a more conservative value, but they also obtained it faster. They probably saved themselves, 6 months, 9 months of study time, maybe even more, to try to obtain a less conservative cleanup value. They just took the number at hand. On slide 87, you can see that a site-specific risk assessment was not conducted for the firing range. And they went with that 250 milligram per kilogram cleanup level. And I believe at this time, they're actually doing additional analysis for protection of ecological systems. On slide 88, that shows the sampling strategy that was used to determine if remediation was successful, where areas in the firing range were identified for excavation, and each excavation area was divided into grids and randomly sampled. And grids where samples failed to result in the cleanup criteria, they were over-excavated and then resampled until the criteria were met. And the grid dimensions were based on excavation efficiency and a balance between being representative of the remediation area and a minimum response to discovery of additional contamination. On slide 89, there you can see that there was an innovative set of criteria that were used. Really a statistical approach was used. So it made the use of a default screening level more robust by looking for the 95 upper confidence level of the mean to determine the success. They also set criteria to avoid any hot spots that somehow slipped through the UCL. They established an upper bound level of 500 milligrams per kilogram. They also established that only 10% of the samples or less could exceed the cleanup criteria, and then the entire site had to pass cleanup as a whole. So there was a lot of analysis done, even though they simply accept the screening level. So that shows you that there are many things you can do in addition to simply taking a screening value. There may, you know, that's a perfectly good option to accept that value and move ahead with your remediation. On slide 90, you can see how this looks when applied to the risk management spectrum, if we apply that to the Evergreen site. The lead concentration contours were established based on those four levels previously described. The lowest concentration, the practical zero level, was the detection limit for XRF. The 250 milligram per kilogram human health level was both the screening level and the site-specific cleanup goal. And then the 500 milligram per kilogram level was the highest concentration, and that was the not-to-exceed criteria for confirmation sampling. So in slide 91, I'd like to summarize both the case studies, put them side by side, and see what they looked like. You can see at the Spring Valley site that Anna described that the compound was arsenic, where there was a background concern Whereas the Evergreen site that I just described led, required no consideration of background. The Spring Valley site, there were current residents and many owners that were stakeholders. At the Evergreen site, there were residents in the future that were considered, and there was only one owner of the facility. At the Spring Valley site, field methods were not primarily used, but at the Evergreen site, they were used for real-time sample analysis. And even the sampling and analysis at Spring Valley was different than at Evergreen, where at Spring Valley it evolved over time. There were both discrete and average samples, and there were composite samples that were done for additional sampling. At the Evergreen site, there was discrete sampling, but there was also a statistical strategy used for investigation of cleanup, and there was no evolution of the cleanup over time. So, you know, you put these things together, and it's very clear that risk management strategies are going to be very different, whether you're dealing with different compounds, different number of stakeholders, and different methodologies for even collecting the data. I mean, how could they all be the same? On slide 92, I have a few more to point out. For Spring Valley, as Anna pointed out, there were a range of risk-based criteria that were used. But at the Evergreen site, there were really two that were used, and in the end, the screen value was established as the cleanup value. The exposure area for Spring Valley was only half-acre residential lots, and the Evergreen site, it was the entire site, although I suppose you consider each excavation to be a smaller subunit. The removal criteria for Spring Valley was consistent with the residents, and at the Evergreen site, they were mixed, and they were based on the depth and location of each contaminant. The criteria for successful removal at Spring Valley and Evergreen were different, where with the statistical criteria at Evergreen. And the risk management decision at Spring Valley involved residents that had a big say in whether or not their trees were going to be excavated, their prized old oaks. And in the Evergreen site, there was the cost-benefit analysis. It had little public input. It was a much simpler from the aspect of risk communication, which, again, could have really torpedoed what went on at Spring Valley. So to review on slide 93, by looking at these case studies, we're able to look at these two case studies and see how site-specific sampling approaches were used and how screening levels and risk assessment kind of interacted and were used as part of managing a project. And we saw how screening levels were applied throughout the project life cycle and how numerical criteria were developed and what sampling approaches were used. And we saw those at both of these two very different sites. So in slide 94, again, we'd like to make a few recommendations and, you know, that we could see even from these site-specific cleanups, we saw how that they were applied after we'd spent a considerable amount of time reviewing these. And, again, you see the need for making the underlying assumptions of where the numbers come from and how they're going to be used very, very clear because, again, you saw that on that Evergreen site, that second site, that, sure, there were screening numbers that were that was the initial intent of the development. They were actually used as cleanup criteria. And on the very first site, you saw how being transparent actually had the stakeholders and the landowners actually solve the difficult problem of meeting a cleanup criteria on their properties. So with that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Anna. Oh, I'm sorry, Juliana.
Thank you, Bennett. On slide 95, we're going to wrap up today's training class, and we're going to have time for a few questions. So if you're in our simulcast audience, you can use that question mark button at the top of the slides to send in your question. For our other participants today, or for all of our participants today, we do ask you to fill out that feedback form, and we show a link to the feedback here on this slide. We also have a link to the additional resources. So going to the additional resources, you can look to the left. You can also access the feedback form from the link here, the third item down, feedback. And we do appreciate if everyone on the call today. Just take a few minutes to fill out that feedback form. We do use the information and really appreciate your input. Looking at the links for today's class, you can download today's ITRC training. That's going to allow you to download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, there's more information in this downloaded version in the speaker's notes section. We also have a link here that will take you over to the ITRC website where you can download the document, Examination of Risk-Based Screening Values and Approaches of Selected States. That's a Risk-1 document. We also have the document, Use of Risk Assessment and Management of Contaminated Sites. That's the Risk-2 document. From the ITRC website, you can download PDFs of both of these documents, as well as access the electronic fact sheet for risk assessment, which includes links to additional resources. Also in Section 2 and continuing on down the page, there are links that will allow you to select different topic areas that you want to look at to get further information. And at the bottom, we include the link to the ITRC or to the Clue-In Studio for announcements. And from that link, you can go and find the Internet-based training seminars and register for the upcoming class on April 27, Use of Risk Assessment and Management of Contaminated Sites. I do want to get to as many questions as we can, and we're going to wrap up in about 5 minutes or so. For our phone line audience, it's *7 to unmute, and please state your name and location. Does anyone in the phone line audience have a question?
Yes, hi, this is Brooks with the Navy in San Diego.
Yes.
I have a question about, on slide 74, you talk about arsenic is identified as the primary contaminant of potential concern. Is the April 27th class going to discuss the methodology for determining arsenic or chemicals as the COPCs? Is it going to go into that kind of depth?
This is Bennett. No, we're not going to focus on that particular case study, you know, or focus on a particular compound. What we're going to do is, again, look at more decision-making, kind of similar to these last case studies, and then look at the risk assessment process. So, yeah, we're not going to look at how it was determined for specific compounds.
But you are going to look at methodology.
Yeah, absolutely, and really the as risk management decisions are being made.
Fantastic, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
A simulcast question from Jen Bannatyne, Geosyntech in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. How is the background arsenic concentration developed? Was sampling performed off-site to establish this value, or was it all determined from data at the site?
No, they did a background sample off-site and collected 42 samples, and then the number 12.6 was the 95% percentile number of the statistical range or average of those data.
From Kathleen Siebenman at U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Sacramento, California, for the Spring Valley site, did there need to be a land use restriction on the deed if the homeowner agreed to the 43 milligram per kilogram remedial goal?
Well, you know, that site's still open and ongoing, and we didn't really go into a lot of details on that endpoint of the whole investigation for the Spring Valley. But I'm sure there's some kind of land use controls. I don't know about the deed stuff, but that's something, if you want to send me an email, we could probably find somebody involved with it that could answer that question further.
Kathleen, if you'd like, you're welcome to follow up, and our instructor's contact information is available on slide 6. Do we have additional questions from our phone line audience?
Beth Rowan in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yes.
And I know that this presentation and looking at the screening values covers primarily the risk from, I guess, contact with the soil concentrations per se. Is there any plans or are there any plans by the RTRC to look at levels that would be established in soils for protection of groundwater? Because I know that some states are starting to do that, and with, I think it was the RBCs, there used to be, or there was a value for soil concentration for protection of groundwater.
This is Bennett. Not at this time. I know that those dilution attenuation factors are still in the regional screening levels, the composite tables, so they're still there. I think this initial exercise and the second exercise, again, we'll have the presentation at the end of the month, were really to try to figure out why are there the differences. And, you know, I think looking at another process or another medium, it will probably be, we'll have the same sort of set of conclusions that there probably are valid technical reasons that are really the basis for the different decision making, and then modifications on managing sites as they go along. So yeah, not at this time. I actually don't know if we included we didn't include dilution attenuation factors in the original document. So yeah, no more on that at this time as planned.
Thank you.
Do we have additional questions from the phone line? Donna Potter at the Washington Department of Ecology in Olympia asks, has anyone done a comparison of risk assessment, risk management approaches for contaminated sediment sites?
I think there is another ITRC team, Juliana, that was looking at contaminated sediments. But I'm not familiar with all the body of work that they've done. But you could check that out on the website.
And this is Juliana. There is a team that does address contaminated sediments, and they're looking at bioavailability considerations. And they'll have an internet-based training available in 2011. And also, Donna, if you're interested in learning more, please contact those team leads as they are working on that product. From Mark Weisberg at Shaw Environmental in Morinville, Pennsylvania, why were carcinogenic effects of arsenic ignored in the selection of the arsenic cleanup goal of 20 milligrams per kilogram?
Well, I was just going to say, it was my understanding from all the discussions with the people involved in the investigation, it wasn't ignored. It was part of a very long, drawn-out stakeholder participation discussion session, you know, because they had to get all the stakeholders and landowners and regulatory people to agree on one number. And I think from what I remember, and Bennett can add anything he knows about, but they started out with you know, carcinogenic values in mind, and they had done a risk assessment, and it was just all the process of what the people there were willing to live with, and how, and, you know, probably the exposure that's, you know, the exposure of somebody, a resident on the lot, and how often they're exposed, and they just had to make choices based on exposures of people and time and concentrations and things.
Thank you. We are out of time. We have a couple of more simulcast questions, and we will follow up on those via email after today's training course. I'd like to thank everyone for participating in today's class. If you have not already, please fill out that feedback form. It is information we use. For more information on ITRC, you can visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again, and have a great day.